Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Wall Street CEOs came to Washington yesterday to testify for the opening of hearings of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, an investigation into the roots of the crisis. Here's Chairman Phil Angelides explaining the goal of the panel.
This forum may be our last best chance to take stock of what really happened so that we can learn from it and restore faith in our economic system. If we ignore history, we're doomed to bail it out again.
CEOs on the hot seat yesterday, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder and SEC Chief. The SEC Chief's testifying today, this hour on Point Wall Street in the hot seat. In Washington, you can join the conversation. What do you hear in the testimony of Wall Street's chiefs? And what should be done to avoid a repeat of the crisis? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from New York is David Widener, columnist for Market Watch and The Wall Street Journal. David, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Glad to be here.
Also with us from New York is Christine Harper, chief financial correspondent for Bloomberg News. Christine, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. It's my pleasure.
Attorney General Eric Holder testifying before this panel this morning, which put the issue of legal action squarely on the table. And I want to ask you about that. If the CEOs, the chiefs were dancing around that yesterday, whether something might really come of that, let's listen to a little bit of Holder's testimony today. This morning, he said the Justice Department was committed to fighting financial crimes, that they would use every tool necessary to catch wrongdoers.
Now, in combating financial crimes, we will aggressively leverage the criminal and civil enforcement resources of the federal government. We will tackle every fraud case with the aim of recovering stolen funds for victims. And we will enhance coordination and cooperation among the federal, state, local, tribal, and territorial authorities so that the perpetrators of these crimes are brought to justice. Now, on this last point, let me be very clear. When we find businesses or individuals whose disregard for the law has hurt the pocketbooks of average Americans, we will use every available measure to hold them accountable.
Attorney General Eric Holder testifying before the panel this morning. Christine, let me come first to you. As the CEOs were testifying yesterday, in the back of their minds, are they worried about criminal prosecution by the U.S. Attorney General about what's transpired over the last year, 2 years and more? Or is it just atmospherics and regulation that they're looking at?
I think it's more about regulation and atmospherics at this point. I mean, if you think about it, the one criminal case we've seen so far related to this crisis has been those Bear Stearns fund managers who ended up being acquitted by a jury because the case was so hard to build and ended up falling down because they were able to say, you know, we were doing our best and we didn't know that the market would melt down the way it did. It seemed to me what we saw a lot of yesterday was people saying, those CEOs were saying, you know, we made mistakes too. We didn't know it was going to go this way. We're not infallible, but that's not a criminal issue. So the question is whether there need to be tighter constraints made on the way they run their businesses so that if they make mistakes in the future, it's not as devastating to the economy and to the American taxpayer.
Not a criminal issue, they'd like to say, and maybe that's the way it is. Of course, we had Goldman Sachs and Bank of America and Morgan Stanley and J.P. Morgan Chase, CEOs all lined up there. Douglas Holtz Aiken is on this commission, among the congressmen on it, economist, and he was questioning the Goldman Sachs chairman, Lloyd Blankfein, yesterday on what they were thinking, what they were aware of as things started to go bad. Let's listen to some of that exchange. Blankfein saying, you know, we all rationalized.
Were you aware of this at the time? Did you see the standards going down? And if so, how did you highlight this in your risk management?
In all honesty, we did know you cannot miss the fact that the covenants are getting a little lighter and that the leverage is getting bigger. With the benefit of hindsight, I wish I weren't in the position of having to explain it. But at the time, I know we all rationalized the way a lot of people, other people had rationalized, gosh, the world is getting wealthier, technology has done things, things are more efficient, interest, there's no inflation, things belong low, these businesses are going to do well. And I think we talked, much as a lot of the world did, talked yourself into a place of complacency, which we should not have gotten ourselves into, and which, of course, after these events, will not happen again in my lifetime, as far as I'm concerned.
David Widener, there's the Goldman Sachs chairman, Lloyd Blankfein. These things will not happen again in our lifetime, as far as I'm concerned. But I guess what we're hearing again and again is that they could happen again. In fact, they're even likely to happen again if things don't change. Did you see mainly theater there yesterday, David, or a ramp being built towards some significant change in the regulatory, you know, foundations of American finance?
Well, to the latter part of your question, I don't see yesterday's hearing suggesting that they're on to something in terms of how they're going to clean up this mess and prevent it in the future. And what Blankfein was saying is not unlike what a lot of these CEOs have been saying over the last couple of years. You know, we just didn't have an idea. Robert Rubin at Citigroup had a very similar defense. We just didn't know. We missed it. And to see the housing bubble, many people on Wall Street were aware that there was a housing bubble. Whether or not they didn't understand that that would lead to the catastrophic failure of the financial system that we saw, it's really hard to believe, considering how well these people were paid to know this and how they're supposed to. You know, he says our business is risk management. Well, they did an absolutely terrible job of that. So, yes, there's a little bit of theater involved. I don't think that we saw much in terms of talking about how we can prevent it. I think the more of it was a look on the past and trying to finger these guys for the mistakes they made and really put them on the spot for that.
We want to absorb what they're saying and see where the pushback may come. Let's get a little more from the Goldman Sachs chairman, Blankfein. Here he's in an exchange with the chairman, Angelides, pressed on whether he realizes that his investment term took on a fundamentally over-the-moon amount of risk.
Looking now, and again, everything is context-driven, and I couldn't be more clear. After 10 benign years in the context where we were, look, how would you look at the risk of a hurricane? The season after we had 4 hurricanes on the East Coast, which was absolutely extraordinary, rates got very low for risk premia on the East Coast of the United States. That year after 4 hurricanes, everyone's nervous of such, rates went up spectacularly, they're lower again. But is the risk of 4 hurricanes any different any of those times?
Mr. Blankfein, I want to say this. Having sat on the board of the California Earthquake Authority, acts of God will exempt. These were acts of men and women.
I'm just saying that if you're asking
these were controllable is my only observation.
I agree. I sit here and read testimony to the effect of reducing our balance sheet, raising capital. Clearly, we are much less leveraged now. Consequently, I wish we were much less leveraged then, even though we were much lower leveraged than others, and we had cash on our balance sheet, and we did better than under those circumstances. But if you're asking me, would I do something differently knowing what I know now with respect to that capitalization? How could you not? Of course.
Would I do something differently? How could you not? Christine, what do you see coming out of this inquiry? It's supposed to harken back to the PCORA hearings after the 1929 crash, which led to pretty fundamental changes in the way American banking and finance were exercised. Do you see anything, something like that coming here?
Right. I think the interesting that comparison is interesting because it highlights how different this commission really is. From what I know of the PCORA commission, I'm not a historian, so I'm not the expert on this, but it was really driven by this prosecutor, Ferdinand PCORA, who was aided by another lawyer and a journalist who did a great deal of research and really brought to the questioning a lot of facts and knowledge that they were able to pin the people they were quizzing with. Yesterday's hearing didn't feel at all like that to me. It just seemed like they'd read some news stories, gotten some general ideas of what people don't like about Goldman Sachs and, you know, general problems in the industry, and had asked and decided to, you know, look really tough on that. But I didn't feel they were building a case out of it. That may change. It may be yesterday was sort of to set the tone. It certainly set a very aggressive tone, at least, you know, with Angelides questioning. still, it didn't come across as a very thought out and extremely prepared case in the way that PCORA, from my understanding, was.
We're going to dig into those exchanges yesterday and hear some more from today as well. But David Widener, how about you? Setting a tone or building a case here? You know, they're supposed to dig into the roots of what happened and recommend change. So do you see something either in the theater up front, or are you aware of things going on behind that may lay the groundwork for that change?
Well, difficult to say at this point. I mean, I don't know specifically where the subpoenas are being handed out on Wall Street, and from what I understand, that this commission is kind of hamstrung in terms of what it's able to gather on Wall Street, because a report I saw said they need an okay by Republicans if they want to actually subpoena people or bring them before the panel.
And you mean subpoena just to testify, not necessarily on the way to a trial, but to get them
correct.
Down there in the dock in a way.
That's mm-hmm. correct. Mm-hmm. But, you know, what we saw yesterday was a very, I agree with Christine, very superficial in terms of what some of the major complaints have been, specifically against Goldman Sachs. I think Goldman was really the firm on the defensive. But until they bring specific transactions before these CEOs, and in Goldman's case, they were accused of course, selling mortgage securities and betting against them. Mm-hmm. Until they bring those specific securities and talk about and bring email correspondence and real paper trails and smoking guns before these guys, I don't see anything, at least so far, that suggests that that's going to happen.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Wall Street in the hot seat in Washington, the hearings there of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, and what may come of them. What we're learning, what we're hearing. Christine Harper from Bloomberg News, chief financial correspondent there, joins us from New York, and David Widener, columnist from Market Watch and the Wall Street Journal, is with us. Here's Sheila Bair, who's been pretty tough on this. She's of course, head of the FDIC. This is today reiterating that the financial crisis was the result of a long-term systemic problem, she said, urging the commission to look at the big picture when considering reform.
This crisis is the culmination of a decades-long process where national policies have skewed economic activity away from savings and toward consumption, away from investment in our industrial base and public infrastructure and toward housing, and away from the real sectors of our economy and toward the financial sector. Examples include federal tax and credit subsidies for housing, compensation practices that promote short-term profit without regard for the long-term risks, and implied, now explicit, government backstops for large financial firms. Such backstops subsidize excessive growth and risk-taking.
There's Sheila Bair, head of the FDIC, going down quite a laundry list. And let's get a little context set here. David Widener, we're in bonus season right now. I mean, checks and the stuff going out this week, tomorrow, we'll learn who's paying what. And we're talking tens, maybe $100-plus billion in bonuses, as I understand. Is that the scale of it?
Well, it's fairly significant. But bonus levels are going to return to probably 2007 levels, which was a record year for Wall Street. So certainly, the recovery aided by the government in the industry is really fueling the big paychecks, and if there's any restraint in terms of compensation on Wall Street, I really haven't seen it. What we're hearing in terms of, especially with Goldman Sachs and Lloyd Blankfein, of course, he urged his bankers who are getting bonuses to give more to charity for.
Yeah.
PR purposes, you know. So there, certainly people have a legitimate question when they say, well, look, if you have failed, if you have made so many mistakes, why are you being compensated? If not for 2007, if not for 2009 and 2008. So there are real questions about tying pay to performance. It doesn't seem to be happening.
Christine, paint the picture for us of the sort of cycle of where this money comes from that ends up in the pocket of Wall Street when it comes to bonuses. I mean, if the giant bailouts weren't there, presumably neither would there be cash for these bonuses. They're basically rooted in the taxpayer pocket, aren't they?
Right. Of course, and all of the CEOs yesterday in their testimony made a very strong point about how they recognize that the government's support was important to the financial industry and the economy as a whole. Of course, they all tried to minimize the degree to which their own firm relied on that. But I think Jamie Dimon at J.P. Morgan, more than anybody, really tried to emphasize that, you know, J.P. Morgan didn't need the money but went along and took it. But they all admit that, you know, the financial system wouldn't be where we are today if the government hadn't stepped in and provided all this money, if the Fed hadn't done what it's done with all its lending programs and its the bailout of AIG was obviously crucial to Goldman, of course, but everybody as well. So there's recognition that this money in some way comes from taxpayer support. And yet, because these banks have all been able to say, well, we've repaid with dividends, with we've given a return to investors on the TARP money that we got, that specific amount of money they got from the Treasury, they're able to say, listen, you know, we're doing all we can. We've paid you back. Now you have to let us in a capitalist system run our business the way we think is best for shareholders. We have a fiduciary duty to the people who invest in our companies. And that includes, we believe, paying ourselves and our employees a lot of money. It's up to shareholders if they don't agree with that. But, you know, there hasn't been a great, very vocal effort by shareholders that I've seen so far to curb compensation. So the government's ability to really clamp down becomes diluted the more these banks return to health, the less it's obvious what kind of subsidies they're getting directly from the government. And that's why you're seeing them return to the practices they were in the past.
And, of course, those were big, big number practices. Goldman Sachs had blank funds, $68 million in 2007. That's a considerable number. Jamie Dimon, J.P. Morgan Chase, pushing back, maybe the most of any of these, saying, you know, stop vilifying us in the last couple of days. Here's some of his testimony before the commission yesterday. J.P. Dimon, CEO, J.P. Morgan Chase.
Some have suggested that size alone or the combination of investment banking and commercial banking caused the crisis. We disagree. If you consider the institutions that failed during the crisis, some of the largest and most consequential failures were standalone investment banks, mortgage companies, thrifts, and insurance companies. Our economy needs financial institutions of all sizes, business models, and areas of expertise to promote economic stability, job creation, and customer service. America's largest companies operate around the world and employ millions of people. These firms need banking partners to operate globally, offer a full range of products and services, and provide financing in billions of dollars. But let me be clear, as I've said before, no institution, including our own, should be too big to fail. We need a regulatory system that provides for even the largest financial firms to be allowed to fail in a way that does not put taxpayers or the broader economy at risk. Shareholders, management, and unsecured creditors should bear the full cost of failure.
That's Jamie Dimon of J.P. Morgan Chase there. Now, David Widener, here's this issue of too big to fail. And he's saying, you know, should even the biggest banks should be allowed to fail. But, of course, the problem was everybody believed we couldn't do that without endangering the whole economy. Many people are saying break these banks up now. Is anybody offering or suggesting that in these hearings or beyond, David?
Well, not so much in the hearings, but the Treasury and the Fed have offered basically a plan that where they think that they will be able to unwind a problem institution without damaging the system, and they want to set up a framework for that, which we didn't have in 2008.
But that's not in advance. That's not now. That's go ahead, let them be very big, and then see if you can unwind that monster once it's got a problem.
Well, it's coupled with other things like new requirements for capital, limits on how much they can leverage themselves. Mm-hmm. So there is kind of a preventive measure, and then there's the measure for if those preventive measures fail. But, you know, to Jamie Dimon's point in regard to, well, you know, it's not about the fact that we have institutions that are too big and are doing too much. You know, up until 1999, we effectively drew a line between investment banking and commercial banking in this country.
Glass-Steagall,
exactly. And, you know, that was a law, basically, that worked. You can't say, you know, we didn't have a catastrophic failure for 60 years after the Great Depression. So we eliminated that, and we allowed all commercial and investment banking to start coexisting. And this meant securities developed on one side were bought by, you know, the bank on the other. And we allowed our money system to become entangled with the casino system of Wall Street. So I have a real problems when someone suggests that it's not the model that's the problem, it's the management, which is what Jamie Dimon is basically arguing.
Right. He's saying, do we see, what about on that? Christine, any moves to bring back Glass-Steagall, that line or something like it?
You know, the problem with the it's not the model, it's the management argument is that you can't legislate management, right? So a lot of people argue that what happened with AIG, and, you know, there are people who dispute this, but what happened with AIG was that it was well managed until suddenly it wasn't. And any of these companies that right now may be able to call themselves very well managed, you know, if you allow them to continue to grow to unlimited size and risks, or, you know, even if you put some limits on them, you know, it's not impossible that someday they just name a manager who makes really bad decisions or isn't that good at risk management. And so you can't rely on good management to be your safeguard. Mm-hmm. You really need to create systems that will limit the risk when something fails. And that's why you're hearing a lot of very experienced people. You've heard Mervyn King at the Bank of England over in the UK. You've heard even Alan Greenspan, many other people calling for some kind of limits on the size of institutions, because if they are able to reach a certain size and take the risk that they're taking, we end up in these situations. You saw Jamie Dimon yesterday. I thought it was very enlightening when he said, you know, my daughter called me from school and she said, what's a financial crisis? And he said, and he was kind of joking with the panel. He said, it's something that happens every 5 to 7 years or something like that.
Great.
And, you know, if you're going to kind of cynically accept that, which I guess, you know, most of the financial community does, then you really have to look at what is the damage when that happens. And that's why you see people like Paul Volcker, mm-hmm. Mervyn King, actually proposing, you know, break up these banks or really restrict the type of risk they can take.
Of course, it's only accepted, even by Wall Street, when there's the prospect of a bailout. Without that, it's real pain. And talk about management. I mean, the thing that got put in the spotlight again yesterday was Goldman Sachs managing, in a way, toward risk, putting together these collateralized debt obligations, packages of subprime mortgages, selling those, talking up their ratings, and then actually themselves betting against those to profit. Angelides, the chairman of the commission, went with that to the CEO, Chairman Lloyd Blankfein, criticizing the practice of betting against some of the very subprime mortgages they were then selling to investors.
I'm just going to be blunt with you. It sounds to me a little bit like selling a car with faulty brakes and then buying an insurance policy on the buyer of those cars. It doesn't seem to me that that's a practice that inspires confidence in the markets.
Every
I'm not talking about your own positions.
Every
I'm talking
purchaser
about betting
of an asset here is an institution,
okay,
probably professional-only investors dedicated, in most cases, to this business.
Representing pension funds who have the life savings of police officers,
these
teachers.
Are the professional investors who want this exposure.
David Widener, what did that exchange mean? Is Blankfein saying they're pros, so we can try and sell them any hornswoggle we can come up with? Is that what
pretty
he's
much.
Saying?
Pretty much. That was really his answer, was that sophisticated investors know what they're doing. And, you know, and I think by inference he was suggesting that, you know, they should probably know that we're going to be hedging our bets on this as well. So it's you know, that's a classic Wall Street argument, but it doesn't sort of pass the common sense test. And I think Angelides was very smart in portraying this in sort of real terms that people can understand. The
selling a car without brakes, faulty brakes.
And then taking an insurance policy against, mm-hmm. you know, on the owner. And I think that's the difference between this commission, which is stocked with former financial pros or people who know Wall Street inside and out, and some of these congressional panels we've seen before, where it's just stocked with congressional people, you know, lawmakers who don't have the expertise and the sophistication that these people do, and they can't expect it to be.
Christine Harper, is this a point, if you know, the equivalent of, the chairman said, selling a used car with faulty brakes and then taking out insurance on it? Can you prosecute criminally on that? Can you regulate away the chance of that happening in the future? Or is that just the tough stuff on Wall Street?
Well, where the rubber hits the road there is kind of on what degree Goldman was upfront with the people they were doing business with about what they were selling them. And Goldman, one of the things they're expert at is the documentation and the contracts they draw up. The people I know who've worked there say the people who do that at Goldman are second to none. So it may just be a matter of they've written very, very smart documents that essentially
cover their assets.
Immunize them from any liability if these things don't work out. And they can say, listen, the problem with Goldman is that at the same time as they're saying all the time, we're here for clients. Our trading business is client driven. They try to make it sound like they're out there doing a service. Really, their fiduciary duty in every transaction they do is to their own stockholders. And Lloyd made that point yesterday. He said, we're not a fiduciary of these people who buy this from it. We're not their asset manager. They're basically a counterparty. They're trading against them. And whenever it's a zero-sum game, as it is often with these trades, Goldman wants to come out ahead.
But in the effectively, with tens of billions between them and others from the taxpayers' pocket.
Exactly. And Goldman, of course, argues in a way that many people can't quite stomach, that they themselves never were at risk because they'd managed themselves carefully enough, and the only risk to them was if the entire system went down, which at one point it looked like it might do, and that's why they needed the money. The problem is they're part of a system. They're a major player in a system that is so fragile and so complex. I mean, John Mack yesterday made a pretty impassioned plea, it seemed to me, about the need to examine the complexity in the markets.
The Morgan Stanley chairman, yeah.
Yeah, sorry. You can tell that for a lot of these people, it's gotten so outlandishly complicated that even the people at the tops of these businesses have no idea what they're doing. And you saw that a little bit when Lehman failed in September 2008. There were a lot of people gathered at the Fed that weekend trying to understand what the ramifications would be, and a lot of the smartest people in the market. And they actually didn't understand how it was going to play out. It played out in a way totally differently from how they expected. That shows you that these people, as much as they think they're on top of the situation, as much as they would like us to believe that, okay, we know what we're doing, we're responsible stewards of this financial system that is the lifeblood of the economy, it's really gotten to a point that unless it gets simplified in some way, unless there's some brakes put on it, we're just going to constantly be put back in these positions.
Christine, David, I've been keeping callers waiting for way too long. Lewis in New York, in Manhattan. Hi, Lewis. You're on the air.
Hi. I think we've got the wrong perspective here. I think these corporations are just being masked by a military financial base. I think we're in the same complex that Eisenhower talked about. Beware of the military-industrial complex.
But subprime mortgages on houses are the root, are the biggest root of this, aren't they, Lewis? I mean, that's a long way from guns.
No, you see, that's the diversion. The truth is these are all mechanisms to centralize money. These are all pretexts to keep centralizing the wealth of the country because these corporations are actually headed by military complexes. And we're being duped. You could not do this unless you had the laws being bent the way they have been bent. No private enterprise could bend law like we've been centralizing wealth in this country.
Lewis, I hear the centralization loud and clear. David, there's been a lot of talk lately about move your money, get it into smaller banks. And with this new tax that's coming now, the Obama administration proposing on the 50 biggest banks, they're counting on competition from smaller banks to spread things out a little bit, I guess, David.
Well, yeah, I think that the message from Washington is definitely that smaller is better. Smaller institutions are better. And they're creating obstacle after obstacle towards including this bank tax against, the Fed looking at pay structures at the banks. They're using all these mechanisms to shrink financial institutions.
David, hold the thought. We've got to take a short break right here. David Widener, Christine Harper with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Wall Street in the hot seat in Washington, the hearings there, and what may come of them, what we're learning, what we're hearing. Joined this hour by David Widener, columnist for Market Watch and the Wall Street Journal, and Christine Harper, chief financial correspondent for Bloomberg News. They're both with us from New York today. And if you want to hear the hemming and hawing about more surveillance or supervision or regulation, listen to this exchange between Commissioner Heather Murren, she's a retired managing director at Merrill Lynch, and again, Goldman Sachs CEO and chairman Lloyd Blankfein.
And there should be more surveillance and more supervision of the kinds of activities that are undertaken by investment banks?
Well, first of all, there's been a clear demarcation between the sociology, for example, of our regulation before and after becoming a bank holding company. So the before that, with the SEC, I'd say the regulation of the Fed is a lot more, a lot more apparent. And there, I mean, every day, dozens of people from the New York Fed come to work in our building, and they come in and they know every part of our business, look at papers, our processes, procedures, and a very, very, our regulation is different now.
So is there a yes in there, that there should be more regulation, more supervision?
Well, there should have been more than there was in September under the old regime, and right now, given that we're still catching up, this is our first year under the Fed, I can't assert that it's not enough. It feels much different. It feels like a lot of regulation, and appropriately a lot. I can't say now that it's not enough.
The sociology of our regulation, it feels like a lot of regulation. Is it, Christine, compared to what there was? I mean, they've got more people in the building. Are they armed with the...
Well, I thought what was actually hilarious, if you listen to Mr. Mm-hmm. Blankfein's comments during that, is that he goes to great efforts not to say that the regulation by the Fed is better. If you listen carefully to what right. he says it's more apparent, it's more there.
There's people around.
And it's different.
Right.
But he doesn't actually say it's improved in any way. And when you heard John Mack from Morgan Stanley's talk about the Fed, he said he did think it was better, mm-hmm. and again emphasized just how many people from the Fed are over there, as though having more people in itself is a better thing. I'm not sure that always is true. Mm-hmm. But I thought it was very enlightening that Mr. Blankfein didn't say it was better, and then is still saying, well, you know, we needed more regulation back in the day, and now I don't really know if we do. A lot of what he does, he's you know, back to the point about whether they saw or didn't see the bubble. Mm. He's very smart, as a lot of these people are, at being able to say, well, on the one hand we do, and on the other hand we don't. You know, so I remember hearing him in 2007 he was on a panel and he was asked what did he see as the biggest risk out there, and people were saying all kinds of things like, you know, regulation or yeah. the dollar or things. And he very, very quickly said he thought it was the risk of a very big credit crisis. So he saw that. And then he quickly also, you know, took the other side and said, except for that, things may be totally different now. So the things that look like risk today may actually prove not to be, because the world is... He basically used all those rationalizations yeah. he described in his testimony yesterday.
Right there.
So,
sort of a
so now he's sort of doing that with the regulation, saying, mm-hmm. well, I don't know, you know, we have different regulation. It's not clear to me we need more. We did need more, but yeah, I just think it's funny.
David Whiter, I want to get you on that, but let me get a caller, a couple here. Stanton, Virginia. David, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I just wanted to offer a perspective from a somewhat grassroots banking perspective. Mm-hmm. I worked for a bank, a community-based bank, for 35 years. I retired at the end of 2004. Mm-hmm. Part of my job, and of course in that kind of community-based bank, you do somewhat everything from time to time.
Sure.
And part of my job throughout that time was to make conforming mortgage loans. And during my time in making those type of loans, we had to verify everything that was put on an application. Everything from employment to previous employment to deposits, every toodle-dick, every...
Yeah, no liar loans, no tell us nothing, we'll just give you the money loans.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Within a couple of years of my retirement, our bank was taken over by a large regional bank. And I'm not saying it was the large regional bank's fault, but within a year, they brought in... mortgage loan originators who were paid on commission. I witnessed personally them interviewing clients, coaching them what to say on their application in order to get their loan approved, mm-hmm. and none of the information on the application had to be verified.
Yeah, just let her fly through, and that's a different world. I appreciate your call, David. Let me get one here from Pawtucket, Rhode Island. Dale, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I believe that far too little attention and far too little blame has been given to the ratings agencies. Had a lot of these securities and derivatives been rated as the junk that they were, it seems to me that nobody's going to buy them, or fewer of the consumers would be buying them, and this thing would be slowed down. And going forward, we need to get the ratings agencies back to being an advocate for the consumers and not beholden to the banks and investment houses that they are now.
Yeah, it's a good point, Dale. David Widener, what about that point? I mean, it was ratings agencies that Goldman Sachs was jawboning on these collateralized debt obligation packages of subprime mortgages that they were betting against. Are they going to be just as vulnerable to that jawboning now? What about regulation on that front?
Regulation on that front is moving through Washington at the same pace as all the other reforms that we've been that the government has been talking about, and that is at a glacial pace. And what's being talked about, the ratings agencies definitely failed on these derivatives, and it was due to conflict of interest. And that's really the problem that the ratings agencies have, is that they're getting paid by the people who need good ratings, and they depend on that business. So the idea is to flip that around and make the investor get a more investor-driven system in place, where the investors are actually handling or paying for the ratings and the research on the securities.
So let them do it. Let's go to Tim in Boston. Tim, you're on the air.
Yes, hello, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I guess from my perspective, this so-called hot seat seems pretty cool to me. The
kind of comfy.
Kind of comfy. And in fact, the CEOs seem to be lording the scene. I'm really of the opinion that we've not seen the end of this crisis, that it won't take 10 years, but probably another 10 months for the remainder of this catastrophe to unfold. And what we've done is effectively insured all of the bondholders and all of the securities holders of these massive banks, and we've kept these buccaneers in power. And if the United States government decides that's the way it wants to run its economy, then we will have the results we have had. There was a reason that regulations were put into place after the Great Depression, and the reason was that the American public suffered so greatly from the enormous risk that people were encouraged to take by people who had no stake in the final outcome, who were going to make money either way. And that's precisely the case now. They have hedged all their bets on Wall Street. They are paying themselves enormous bonuses because their thinking is extraordinarily short-term. And if the United States government doesn't look out for the interests of the citizens of the United States, then there's no hope. What the United States government needs to do is to establish a strategic direction for the economy and install regulations to affect that change. Otherwise, these pirates are going to drive us into the ground, and it won't take a long time.
Tim, I'm ready to put you right at the head of that table there in Washington. But Christine Harper, you hear Tim's complaint and his kind of prescription implicit in it, and it's not as though it's hard to find that or hear that, and yet David Widener says things moving at a glacial pace. Your colleagues at Bloomberg Businessweek have been writing about why that may be so on Capitol Hill. What's the sand in the gears? What's the friction on getting some better reform here, Christine?
Well, I mean, I think it comes down to money. You know, these companies have an enormous amount of money. They have a lot of money at stake in this reform effort, and so they're spending it to try to influence the debate. And a lot of the groups that may have the other side of the view, like the taxpayers, aren't as necessarily as well organized and well represented. So when it comes down to discussions behind the scenes at any one of these House or Senate committees that are making these laws, some of their old friends who are big campaign contributors can have a big influence that changes the discussion from what we may assume as taxpayers it would be normally. One of my colleagues at Bloomberg wrote a column today where he said one of the benefits of this commission could be really examining the intersection of finance and government, because clearly congressional panels that are doing their own research won't necessarily dive into that as well as maybe this commission could do. The problem is, of course, this commission has a lot of political ties as well.
$300 million some spent by banks on lobbying this year. Let's listen to what at least one of the CEOs did say about what they would do, how they would respond. This is John Mack, chairman of Morgan Stanley, describing their kind of game plan. And David, Christina, I want to get your analysis of how effective this might be.
Morgan Stanley also devoted significant resources over the last 2 years to further strengthen our risk management policies and procedures, this including naming a new risk officer early in 2008 and adding about 100 more people to the risk management process. We have enacted changes to how we pay our employees and ensure that compensation is linked even more closely to performance and does not encourage excessive risk-taking. We were the first major U.S. bank to enact a clawback for a portion of year-end compensation in 2008, one that exceeded TARP requirements. We have since strengthened this provision further so we can claw back compensation for up to 3 years if investments or trading positions produce subsequent losses. We've also enacted a new multi-year performance plan that makes a portion of senior executives' year-end compensation contingent on reaching certain 3-year performance goals. And we're increasing a portion of year-end compensation that's deferred to all employees. Finally, as CEO, I recommend to the board that I receive no bonus in 2009 because of the unprecedented environment in which we're operating and the government's extraordinary financial support to our industry.
John Mack, chairman of Morgan Stanley. David Widener, just look at that with us for a minute. Now, you said no bonus for him this year, and of course that can be giving up a lot. As we said, Blankfein had a $68 million bonus a couple of years ago. Multi-year performance plan with the compensation contingent on a 3-year performance goals, clawback for a portion of compensation if things don't work out so well. Is that the beginning of something different, David, or is that just at the edges?
Well, it's a start. You know, I think Morgan Stanley has been the most progressive bank of the big or investment bank of the big investment banks on Wall Street when it comes to pay. Everybody's ratcheted down their leverage, so they're not really alone in that. But their pay plan gives a nod to what people in Washington and people who want to reform Wall Street want to see, and that is basically tying pay to risk and making certain that decisions that you make this year that you're not going to get a short-term gain on something that's going to blow up and put the company or the system at risk in the years to come. And so the idea of deferring it through restricted stock or clawbacks is on the right path, I think.
Let's get one more call. Berksville, Kentucky. Mary, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was wondering why they can't just repeal this Securities Modernization Act that I thought the Clintons kind of shoved, or the Republicans shoved down Clinton's throat. I thought, you know, sort of paved the way for a lot of this. And
just roll her back.
Yeah.
So let's see. Christine Harper, Securities Modernization Act. Is that the one right at the end of the 90s that brought down Glass-Steagall, Christine?
I don't know if
David?
The caller is referring to that. That would be the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act. Is that what you mean?
I don't know. I seem to think it was called the Securities Modernization Act.
Yeah, I think it's one
and
the same.
Do you think it's the same? The two mm-hmm. Clinton era reforms were that which did away with the restriction on investment banks and commercial banks being in the same business. Mm-hmm. And I think Clinton during the Clinton era, there was also limits put on the amount of regulation that could be applied to the derivatives markets.
We know Phil Graham was very, very strong in that. But what about it? Any chance of that being brought back, or are people just laughing at the idea of Glass-Steagall?
There is talk. I mean, ironically, it's coming from the Republicans. John McCain and Maria Cantwell have proposed a bill to to reinstate that Glass-Steagall separation. A lot of people who are critics of that, though, say that's not really the solution. And even Paul Volcker doesn't want that per se. He wants just changes in the way that the biggest banks are allowed to operate with certain risks not allowed.
So keep an eye right there. David Widener, what are you going to be watching as this commission's work goes forward to make your own final judgment on whether this is, you know, kabuki theater or something more?
I want to get a sense of what's on the table for them in terms of how, you know, is bringing back. See, I'm not against the idea of something like Glass-Steagall returning to the marketplace. And I want to see that all bets are still on and that all options are still available, that they haven't already come to the table buying the industry line that, well, we can't go back because it'd be too complicated and we can't unwind or put that back in the box. It's already too far gone. So if they're willing to take drastic steps, then I'm going to watch it very closely.
Well, we're very grateful to each of you for being with us today. David Widener at MarketWatch and the Wall Street Journal joining us from New York City. David, thank you very much for your time and thoughts today.
Oh, my pleasure.
And Christine Harper, Chief Financial Correspondent for Bloomberg News. Thanks for listening in on these hearings with us, Christine. Great to have you.
Thanks. It was fun.
Listeners, thank you for joining us. We'll keep listening. We always appreciate your input. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Julie Jupp, Sam Gail Rosen, Ping Wong, Eileen Mata, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and John Wibby. With help from Shireen Jafari, our senior producer is Wen Stevenson. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.